myself, had already run once from the Communists in 54, my 9-year-old self having no say in the matter. To rendezvous in the church amused Nan, a former Catholic like me. While we pretended to be devout officers for whom Mass once a week did not suffice, I would confess my political and personal failures to him. He, in turn, would play my confessor, whispering to me absolutions in the shape of assignments rather than prayers. America? I said. America, he confirmed. I had told him of the general's evacuation plan as soon as I learned of it, and that past Wednesday in the Basilica, I was informed of my new task. This mission was given to me by his superiors, but who they were I did not know. It was safer this way. This had been our system since our lycée days, when we secretly pursued one road via a study group, while Bonn openly continued on a more conventional path. The study group had been Mann's idea, a 3-man cell consisting of himself, me, and another classmate. Mann was the leader, guiding us in the reading of revolutionary classics, and teaching us the tenets of party ideology. At the time, I knew that Mann was part of another cell where he was the junior member, although the identities of the others were a mystery to me. Both secrecy and hierarchy were key to revolution, Mann told me. That was why there was another committee above him for the more committed, and above that another committee for the even more committed, and on until we, presumably, reached Uncle Ho himself, at least when he was alive. The most committed man ever, the one who had asserted that nothing is more precious than independence and freedom. These were words we were willing to die for. This language, as well as the discourse of study groups, committees, and parties, came easily to man. He had inherited the revolutionary gene from a great uncle, dragooned by the French to serve in Europe during World War I. He was a gravedigger, and nothing will do more to bestir a colonized subject than seeing white men naked and dead, the great uncle said, or so man told me. This great uncle had stuck his hands in their slimy pink viscera, examined at leisure their funny, flaccid willies, and retched on seeing the putrefying scrambled eggs of their brains. He buried them by the thousands, brave young men, enmeshed in the cobweb eulogies spun by spidery politicians, and the understanding that France had kept its best for its own soil slowly seeped into the capillaries of his consciousness. The mediocrities had been dispatched to Indochina, allowing France to staff its colonial bureaucracies with the schoolyard bully, the chess club misfit, the natural-born accountant, and the diffident wallflower, whom the great uncle now spotted in their original habitat as the outcasts and losers they were. And these cast-offs, he fumed, were the people who taught us to think of them as white demigods? His radical anti-colonialism was enhanced when he fell in love with a French nurse, a Trotskyist, who persuaded him to enlist with the French communists, the only ones offering a suitable answer to the Indochina question. For her, he swallowed the black tea of exile. Eventually, he and the nurse had a daughter, and handing me a slip of paper, Mann whispered that she was still there, his aunt. On the slip of paper was her name and address in the 13th arrondissement of Paris. This fellow traveler who had never joined the Communist Party, and thus was unlikely to be surveilled. I doubt you'll be able to send letters home, so she'll be the go-between. She's a seamstress with 3 Siamese cats, no children, and no suspicious credentials. That's where you'll send the letters. Fingering that slip of paper, I recalled the cinematic scenario I had prepared, the one where I refused to board Claude's plane while the general pleaded hopelessly with me to leave with him. I want to stay, I said. It's almost over. Behind clasped hands, man sighed. Is it almost over? Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Your general isn't the only one planning to keep on fighting. Old soldiers don't fade away. The war has been going on too long for them to simply stop. We need someone to keep an eye on them and make sure they're not going to get into too much trouble. What happens if I don't go? I asked. Man raised his eyes to the bruised, greenish Christ with his European features, suspended on a crucifix high above the altar, the lie of a loincloth draped around his groin, when in all likelihood he died naked. The grin on man's face revealed startlingly white teeth. "You'll do more good there than you will here," this dentist's son said. "And if you don't do it yourself, do it for Bon. He won't go if he thinks we're staying. But in any case, you want to go. Admit it." "Dare I admit it? Dare I confess? America, land of supermarkets and superhighways, of supersonic jets and Superman, of supercarriers and the Super Bowl. America, a country not content simply to give itself a name on its bloody birth, but one that insisted, for the first time in history, on a mysterious acronym, USA, a trifecta of letters outdone later only by the quartet of the USSR. Although every country thought itself superior in its own way, was there ever a country that coined so many super terms from the Federal Bank of its narcissism? Was not only super confident, but also truly super powerful, that would not be satisfied until it locked every nation of the world into a full Nelson and made it cry, "Uncle Sam"? "All right, I admit it," I said. "I confess." He chuckled and said, "Consider yourself lucky. I've never left our wonderful homeland." "Lucky, am I? At least you feel at home here." "Home is overrated," he said. Easy for him to say when his father and mother got along reasonably well, while his siblings looked the other way when it came to his revolutionary sympathies. This was common enough when many a family was divided against itself, some fighting for the North and some for the South, some fighting for communism and some for nationalism. Still, no matter how divided, all saw themselves as patriots, fighting for a country to which they belonged. When I reminded him that I did not belong here, he said, "You don't belong in America either." "Perhaps," I said. "But I wasn't born there. I was born here." Outside the basilica, we said goodbye, our real farewell, not the one stage later for Bonn. "I'm leaving you my records and my books," I said. "I know you've always wanted them." "Thanks," he said, squeezing my hand hard. "And good luck." "When do I get to come home?" I asked. Giving me a look of great sympathy, he said, "My friend, I am a subversive, not a seer. The timetable for your return will depend on what your general plans." And as the general drove by the basilica, I could not say what his plans were besides escaping the country. I only assumed that he had more in mind than the futile words emblazoned on the banners flanking the boulevard leading to the presidential palace, which a dissident pilot had strafed earlier in the month. "No land to the communists, no communists in the South, no coalition government, no negotiation." I could see an impassive guardsman standing impaled at attention under his roof post, but before we reached the palace, the general finally, mercifully, set a course for the airport by turning right on Pasteur. Somewhere far away, a heavy machine gun fired in uneven staccato bursts. When a dull mortar grunted, Duke whimpered in his mother's arms. "Hush, darling," she said. "We're only going on a trip." Bon stroked his son's wispy hair and said, "Will we ever see these streets again?" I said, "We have to believe we'll see them again, don't we?" Bon draped his arm over my shoulders and we squeezed together into the stairwell, hanging our heads out the door and holding hands as the glum apartments rolled by. Lights and eyes speaking from behind curtains and shutters. Noses to the wind, we inhaled a farrago of scents, charcoal and jasmine, rotting fruit and eucalyptus, gasoline and ammonia, a swirling belch from the city's poorly irrigated gut. As we approached the airport, the shadowy cross of an airplane roared overhead, all lights extinguished. At the gates, prickly rolls of barbed wire sagged with middle-aged disappointment. Behind the wire waited a squad of sullen military policemen and their young lieutenant, rifles in hand and truncheons swinging from belts. My chest thumped as the lieutenant approached the General Citroen, leaned down by the driver's window to exchange a few words, then glanced in my direction where I stood leaning out the door of the bus. I had tracked him down on the Louche Major's information, to the canal-side slum he lived with his wife, three children, parents, and in-law, all of whom were dependent on a salary that was not enough to feed half of them. This was the typical lot of the young officer. But my task on the afternoon I visited last week was to discover what kind of man had been molded from this poor clay. In his skivvies, sitting on the edge of the wooden bed he shared with his wife and children, the half-naked lieutenant had the cornered look of a political prisoner freshly dropped into a tiger cage, wary and a bit frightened, but not yet physically broken. "You want me to stab my country in the back?" he said tonelessly, the unlit cigarette I had given him in his hand. "You want me to let cowards and traitors escape? You want me to encourage my men to do the same?" "I am not going to insult your intelligence by pretending otherwise," I said. I spoke mostly for the benefit of the jury, his wife, parents, and in-laws, who sat, squatted, or stood in the tight confines of the sweltering, tin-roofed shack. Hunger had lent them emaciated cheekbones, the kind I knew from my own mother, who had suffered so much for me. "I admire you, Lieutenant," I said, and I did. "You're an honest man, and it's hard to find honest men when men have families to feed. The least I can do to reward you is to offer you $3,000. This was a month's salary for his entire platoon. His wife did her duty and demanded 10. Eventually, we agreed on 5, half paid then, half due at the airport. As my bus rolled by, he snatched from my hand the envelope with the cash, and in his eyes I saw the same look the communist agent had given me when I had pulled that list of names from her mouth. Although he could have shot me or turned us back, he did what I gambled every honorable man forced to take a bribe would do. He let us all pass, holding up his end of the bargain as the last fig leaf of his dignity. I averted my eyes from his humiliation. If, let me indulge in the conditional for a moment, if the Southern Army comprised only men like him, it would have won. I confess that I admired him, even though he was my enemy. It is always better to admire the best among our foes rather than the worst among our friends. Wouldn't you agree, Commandant? It was nearly 9 as we drove through the metropolis that was the airport complex, on well-paved streets, past Quonset huts, gabled barracks, nondescript offices, and tubular warehouses, deep into a miniature city in Saigon, yet outside of it. This semi-autonomous territory was once one of the world's busiest airports, a hub for all kinds of lethal and non-lethal sorties and missions, including those flown by Air America, the CIA's airline. Our generals stashed their families here, while American generals crafted their stratagems in offices stocked with imported steel furniture. Our destination was the compound of the Defense Attaché office. With typical cheekiness, the Americans had nicknamed it Dodge City, the town where six-shooters ruled and where saloon girls danced the can-can, as was much the case here in Saigon. But while sheriffs kept the peace in the real Dodge City, American Marines guarded this evacuation center. I had not seen so many since 73, when they were a ragged, defeated lot departing from this airfield. But these young Marines had never seen combat, and had been in this country only a few weeks, bright-eyed and clean-shaven, with not a hint of a needle track in the crooks of their arms, or a whiff of marijuana in their pressed, jungle-free fatigues. They watched impassively as our passengers disembarked into a parking lot already crowded with hundreds of other nervous evacuees. I joined the general and Claude by the Citroën, where the general was handing over his keys. "I'll return them in the States, sir," Claude said. "No, leave them in the ignition," the general said. "I would not want anyone to damage the car while they steal it, since it will be stolen anyway. Enjoy her while you can, Claude." When the general wandered off to find Madame and the children, I said, "What's going on here? It's a mess." Claude sighed. "Situation normal, all fucked up. Everybody's trying to get their relatives and cooks and girlfriends out of here. Just consider yourself lucky." "I know," I said. "See you in the States?" He clapped me on the shoulder with affection. Just like when the communists took over in 54, he said, "Who would have thought we'd be here again? But I got you out of the North then, and I'm getting you out of the South now. You'll be all right." After Claude left, I returned to the evacuees. A Marine on the bullhorn mumbled at them to form into lines, but queuing was unnatural for our countrymen. Our proper mode in situations where demand was high and supply low was to elbow, jostle, crowd, and hustle, and, if all that failed, to bribe, flatter, exaggerate, and lie. I was uncertain whether these traits were genetic, deeply cultural, or simply a rapid evolutionary development. We had been forced to adapt to 10 years of living in a bubble economy pumped up purely by American imports. 3 decades of on-again, off-again war, including the sawing in half of the country in 54 by foreign magicians, and the brief Japanese interregnum of World War II, and the previous century of avuncular French molestation. The Marines, however, cared not a whit for such excuses, and their intimidating presence eventually coerced the refugees into lines. When the Marines checked us for weapons, we officers dutifully, sadly, turned over our guns. Mine was just a snub-nosed 38 revolver, good for covert activities, Russian roulette, and suicide, whereas Bonn wielded the manly 45 Colt semi-automatic. The gun was designed to knock down Moro warriors in the Philippines with a single shot, I said to Duke. I had learned this from Claude. It was the kind of arcana he knew. Papers, said the embassy bureaucrat at the desk after the weapons check. A young man with 19th-century sideburns, decked out in a beige safari suit and rose-tinted glasses. Each of the family heads had the laissez-passer documents from the Ministry of the Interior I had bought at a hefty discount, as well as the presidential parole delivered by Claude, stamped by the relevant embassy clerk. The parole assured us, even as we stood obediently in line, of the important thing, that we had cut to the head of the immigration queue in front of the huddled, hopeful millions from all over the world yearning to breathe free. We carried that small solace with us to the staging ground of the tennis courts, where earlier evacuees already occupied all the bleacher seats. We joined the tardier souls attempting a numb slumber on the green concrete of the courts. Red blackout lamps cast an eerie glow over the crowds, among which was a scattering of Americans. All of them appeared to be husbands of Vietnamese women, given how a Vietnamese family besieged each of them, or how a Vietnamese woman had practically handcuffed herself to his arm. I settled down with Bon, Lin, and Duke on an unoccupied plot. On one side was a covey of call girls, vacuum-packed into micro-miniskirts and fishnet stockings. On the other was an American, his wife and their children, a boy and a girl of perhaps 5 or 6. The husband sprawled on his back with his beefy forearm over his eyes. The only parts of his face visible, the 2 furry limbs of his walrus mustache, his pink lips, and his slightly crooked teeth. His wife sat with her children's head in her lap, stroking their brown hair. "How long have you been here?" Lin asked, cradling a drowsy Duke in her arms. "The whole day," the woman said. "It's been awful, so hot. There's nothing to eat or drink. They keep calling out the numbers of planes, but not ours." Lin made sympathetic noises while Bon and I settled down to the waiting part of hurry up and wait. The tedious custom of militaries the world over. We lit cigarettes and turned our attention to the dark sky, every now and again illuminated by a parachute flare, sputtering into spermatic existence, its bright head of light trailing a long, wiggling tail of smoke as it drifted downward. "Ready for a confession?" Bon said. He used words the way he used bullets, in short, controlled bursts. "I knew today was coming. Just never said so aloud. That's denial, right?" I nodded and said, "You're only guilty of the same thing that everyone else in Saigon is. We all knew, and we couldn't do a thing about it. Or so we thought, anyway. But anything can always happen. That's what hope is all about." He shrugged, contemplating the end of his burning cigarette. "Hope's thin," he said. "Despair's thick, like blood." He pointed to the scar in the palm of the hand holding the cigarette, carved to follow the lifetime's arc. "Remember?" I held up the palm of my right hand with its matching scar, the same one carried by man. We saw this mark whenever we opened our hands for a bottle, a cigarette, a gun, or a woman. Like warriors of legend, we had sworn to die for one another, snared by the romance of schoolboy friendship, united by the eternal thing we saw in each other. Fidelity, honesty, conviction, the willingness to stand by friends and uphold beliefs. But what did we believe in at 14? Our friendship and our brotherhood, our country and our independence. We believed we could, if called upon, sacrifice ourselves for our blood brothers and our nation. But we did not know exactly how we would be called upon and what we would become. I could not predict that Bond would one day join the Phoenix program to avenge his murdered father, his talk to assassinate the people whom Mann and I considered comrades. And good-hearted, sincere Bond did not know that Mann and I would secretly come to believe that the only way to rescue our country was to become revolutionaries. All three of us followed our political beliefs, but only because of the reasons that led us to swear blood brotherhood in the first place. If ever circumstances forced us into a situation where death was the price of our brotherhood, I had no doubt that Mann and I would pay. Our commitment was written on our hands, and under the wavering light cast by a distant magnesium flare, I held up my palm with its scar and traced a line with my finger. "Your blood is mine, and mine is yours," I said, which was the adolescent oath we had sworn to one another. "You know what else?" Bond said. "Despair may be thick, but our friendship's thicker." After that, nothing more needed to be said. Our camaraderie enough, as we heeded the call of the Katria rockets, hissing in the distance like librarians demanding silence. Chapter 3. "Thank you, dear Commandant, for the notes that you and the Commissar have given me on my confession. You have asked me what I mean when I say we or us, as in those moments when I identify with the Southern soldiers and evacuees on whom I was sent to spy. Should I not refer to those people, my enemies, as them? I confess that having spent almost my whole life in their company, I cannot help but sympathize with them, as I do with many others. My weakness for sympathizing with others has much to do with my status as a bastard, which is not to say that being a bastard naturally predisposes one to sympathy. Many bastards behave like bastards, and I credit my gentle mother with teaching me the idea that blurring the lines between us and them can be a worthy behavior. After all, if she had not blurred the lines between maid and priest, or allowed them to be blurred, I would not exist. Having been thus produced outside of marriage, I confess to feeling very uncomfortable at the thought of being married myself. Bachelorhood is one of the unexpected benefits of being a bastard, as I was not considered much of a catch to most families. Not even families with a daughter of mixed ancestry welcomed me, for the daughter was herself usually frantic to squeeze into the elevator of social mobility through marriage to someone of a pure pedigree, while friends and strangers sigh over my bachelorhood as part of the tragedy of being a bastard. I find that bachelorhood not only means freedom, but also suits my subterranean life as a mole, who burrows better alone. Being a bachelor also meant I could chat without consequence with the call girls, brazenly displaying their shapely shanks among the evacuees, while using yesterday's tabloid paper to fan the sweaty ravines of their cleavage, artificially enhanced by atomic age bras. The girls called themselves Mimi, Fifi, and Titi, common enough names in the demi-monde, but as a triumvirate powerful enough to inject joy into my heart. Perhaps they invented those names on the spot. Names changed as easily as customers. If so, their play-acting was simply a professional reflex acquired through years of diligent study and dedicated practice. I had an abiding respect for the professionalism of career prostitutes, who wore their dishonesty more openly than lawyers, both of whom bill by the hour. But to speak only of the financial side misses the point. The proper way to approach a prostitute is to adapt the attitude of a theater-goer, sitting back and suspending disbelief for the duration of the show. The improper way is to doltishly insist that the play is just a bunch of people putting on charades because you have paid the price of the ticket, or, conversely, to believe utterly in what you are watching and hence succumb to a mirage. For example, grown men who sneer at the idea of unicorns will tearfully testify to the existence of an even rarer, more mythical species, found only in remote ports of call and the darkest, deepest reaches of the most insalubrious taverns. This is the prostitute in whose chest beats the proverbial heart of gold. Let me assure you, if there is one part of a prostitute that is made of gold, it is not her heart. That some believe otherwise is a tribute to the conscientious performer. By this degree, the three call girls were troopers, which could not be said of 70 or 80% of the prostitutes in the capital and outlying cities, of whom sober studies, anecdotal evidence, and random sampling indicate the existence of tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands. Most were poor, illiterate country girls with no means of making a living except to live as ticks on the fur of the 19-year-old American GI, his pants bulging with an inflationary roll of dollars, and his adolescent brain swollen with the yellow fever that afflicts so many Western men who come to an Asian country. This American GI discovered to his surprise and delight that in this green-breasted world he was no longer Clark Kent, but Superman, at least in the regards of women. Aided, or was it invaded, by Superman, our feckin' little country no longer produces significant amounts of rice, rubber, and tin, cultivating instead an annual bumper crop of prostitutes, girls who had never so much as danced to a rock song before the pimps we called cowboys slapped pasties on their quivering country breasts and prodded them onto the catwalk of a Tudor bar. Now, am I daring to accuse American strategic planners of deliberately eradicating peasant villages in order to smoke out the girls who would have little choice but to sexually service the same boys who bombed, shelled, strafed, torched, pillaged, or merely forcibly evacuated said villages? I am merely noting that the creation of native prostitutes to service foreign privates is an inevitable outcome of a war of occupation. One of those nasty little side effects of defending freedom that all the wives, sisters, girlfriends, mothers, pastors, and politicians in Smallville, USA, pretend to ignore behind waxed and buffed walls of teeth as they welcome their soldiers home, ready to treat any unmentionable afflictions with the penicillin of American goodness. This trio of talented stars promise another kind of goodness altogether, the bad kind. They flirted shamelessly with me, and teased Bond and the American husband with the walrus mustache, now awake. Both merely grimaced and made themselves as still and small as they could, quite aware of the grim silence of the wives. I, on the other hand, flirted happily in return, perfectly mindful that each of these demi-mondaines had a backstory capable of breaking my heart and, most likely, my bank account. Did I not have one of these same backstories? But performers perform at least partially to forget their sadness, a trait I am well acquainted with. In these situations, it is better to flirt and play, allowing everyone the opportunity to pretend to be happy for so long that they might actually feel such happiness. And it was a pleasure just to look at them. Mimi was tall, with long straight hair and pink nail polish on all 20 digits, their tips as glossy as jelly beans. Her throaty voice with its mysterious Hui dialect compelled all my blood vessels to constrict, making me a touch lightheaded. Titi was fragile and petite, a fabulous beehive hairdo adding height. Her pale skin evoked eggshells. Her eyelashes trembled with a hint of dew. I wanted to wrap her in my arms and brush my eyelashes against hers in butterfly kisses. Fifi was the leader, her body's curves reminding me of the dunes of Phan Thiet, where my mother had taken me for the one vacation of her life. While Mama covered herself from head to toe so she would not get any darker, I grubbed in the sun-baked sand ecstatically. That blissful memory of a 10-year-old's warmth and happiness was aroused by Fifi's fragrance, the same, nearly, or so I imagined, as from the one tiny vial of honey-colored perfume my mother owned, a present from my father with which she anointed herself once a year. So I fell in love with Fifi, a harmless enough emotion. I was wont to fall in love 2 or 3 times a year, and was now well past due. As to how they had managed to infiltrate this bear base, when evacuations were meant for the rich, the powerful, and or the connected, it was all because of Sarge. I imagined a slab of beefcake on 2 legs with a white marine's cap perched on top. Sarge guards the embassy and just loves us girls, Fifi said. He's a sweetheart, a doll. He didn't forget us at all, just like he said he would never forget us. The other two nodded vigorously, Mimi cracking her gum and Titi cracking her knuckles. Sarge got a bus and drove up and down Tudo, rescuing as many of us girls as were around who wanted to leave. Then he got us on the airbase by telling the cops he was bringing us for a party with the poor boys here. The hard peach of my heart ripened and softened as I thought of their Sarge, this swell American who actually kept his promises, first name Ed and last name something none of the girls could pronounce. I asked them why they wanted to leave, and Mimi said because the communists were sure to imprison them as collaborators. They call us whores, she said. And they call Saigon the whore city, don't they? Honey, I can connect the dots. Plus, Titi said, even if we're not tossed in jail, we couldn't do our work. You can't buy or sell anything in a communist country, right? Not for a profit, anyway. And, darling, I am not letting anyone eat this mango for free. Communism or no communism. At this, all three hooted and clapped. They were as ribald as Russian sailors on shore leave. But they also had a firm grasp of the theory of exchange value. What indeed would happen to girls like them once the revolution was victorious? To this matter, I confess that I had not devoted much thought. Their spirited elan made the time fly by as quickly as the C-130s flashing overhead. But even they and I got tired as the hours progressed and our numbers were not called. The Marine with the bullhorn would mumble like a throat cancer victim with a mechanical larynx, and an exhausted company of evacuees would gather their pitiful belongings and stumble for the buses that would deliver them to the tarmac. 10 o'clock passed, then 11. I lay down and could not sleep, even though I was in what soldiers, with their usual wit, called a 1,000-star hotel. All I need do was look up to the galaxy to remind myself of my good luck. I squatted and smoked another cigarette with Bon. I lay down and again could not sleep, bothered by the heat. At midnight, I took a walk around the compound and poked my head in the toilets. This was a bad idea. They had been meant to handle only the normal flow of a few dozen office workers and rear echelon military types, not the hot waste of thousands of evacuees. The scene at the swimming pool was no better. For all the years of its existence, the swimming pool was an American-only area, with passes for the whites of other countries and for the Indonesians, Iranians, Hungarians, and Poles of the International Committee of Control and Supervision. Our country was overrun by acronyms, with the ICCS, otherwise known as I Can't Control Shit, its role to oversee the ceasefire between North and South after the American armed forces strategically relocated. It was a smashingly successful ceasefire, for in the last 2 years only 150,000 soldiers had died, in addition to the requisite number of civilians. Imagine how many would have died without a truce. Perhaps the evacuees resented the exclusion of locals from this pool, but more likely they were just desperate when they turned it into a urinal. I joined the tinkling line standing at the pool's edge, then returned to the tennis courts. Vaughn and Lynn dozed with their hands cupping their chins, Duke the only one getting any sleep at all in his mother's lap. I squatted, I lay down, I smoked a cigarette, and so on, until at nearly 4 in the morning... our number was at last called, and I bid farewell to the girls, who pouted and promised we would see each other again on Guam. We marched forth from the tennis court toward the parking lot, where a pair of buses waited to take on more than our group of 92 evacuees. The crowd was around 200, and when the general asked me who these people were, I asked the nearest Marine. He shrugged. "Y'all ain't too big, so we're putting two of you on for every one of us." Part of me was irritated as I boarded the bus after my unhappy general, while part of me reasoned that we were used to such treatment. After all, we treated each other in the same way, cramming our motorbikes, buses, trucks, elevators, and helicopters with suicidal loads of human cargo, disregarding all regulations and manufacturer recommendations. Was it any surprise that other people thought we were happy with conditions to which we were merely resigned? "They wouldn't treat an American general this way," the general complained, pressed against me in the tight confines. "No, sir, they wouldn't," I said. and it was most likely true. Our bus was immediately fetid and hot from the passengers, who had been simmering outdoors all day and night. But it was only a short way to our parked C-130 Hercules. The plane was a garbage truck with wings attached, and like a garbage truck, deposits were made from the rear, where its big flat cargo ramp dropped down to receive us. This mall led into a generous alimentary canal, its membrane illuminated by a ghostly green blackout light. Disembarked from the bus, the general stood to one side of the ramp, and I joined him, to watch as his family, his staff, their dependents, and 100 people we did not know climbed aboard, waved on by a loadmaster standing on the ramp. "Come on, don't be shy," he said to Madame, his head encased in a helmet the size and shape of a basketball. "Nut to butt, lady, nut to butt." Madame was too puzzled to be shocked, her forehead wrinkled as she passed with her children, attempting to translate the loadmaster's mindless refrain. Then I spotted a man coming to the ramp doing his best to avoid eye contact, a blue Pan Am travel bag clutched to his incurved chest. I had seen him a few days prior at his house in District 3. A mid-ranking apparatchik in the Ministry of the Interior, he was neither too tall nor too short, too thin nor too wide, too pale nor too dark, too smart nor too dumb. Some species of sub-undersecretary, he probably had neither dreams nor nightmares, his own interior as hollow as his office. I had thought of the sub-undersecretary a few times in the days since our meeting, and could not recall his elusive face. But I recognize him now as he ascended the ramp. When I clapped my hand on his shoulder, he twitched, and finally turned his chihuahua eyes toward me, pretending not to have seen me. "What a coincidence," I said. "I didn't expect to see you on this flight. General, our seats would not have been possible without the help of this kind gentleman." The general nodded stiffly, baring his teeth just enough to indicate that he should never be expected to reciprocate. "My pleasure," the sub-undersecretary whispered, slight frame quivering and wife tugging at his arm. If looks could emasculate, she would have walked off with my sack in her purse. After the crowd pushed them by, the general glanced at me and said, "Was it a pleasure?" "Of a sort," I said. When all the passengers had boarded, the general motioned for me to go before him. He was the last to walk up the ramp into a cargo hold with no seats. Adults squatted on the floor or sat on bags, children perched on their knees. Lucky passengers had a bulkhead berth where they could cling to a cargo strap. The contours of skin and flesh separating one individual from another merged. Everyone forced into the mandatory intimacy required of those less human than the ones leaving the country in reserve seating. Bon, Lin, and Duke were somewhere in the middle, as were Madame and her children. The ramp slowly rose and clamped shut, sealing us worms into our can. Along with the loadmaster, the general and I leaned against the ramp, our knees in the noses of the passengers before us. The quartet of turboprop engines turned over with a deafening racket, the vibrations rattling the ramp. As the plane grumbled its way along the tarmac, the whole population rocked back and forth with every motion, a congregation swaying to inaudible prayers. The acceleration pressed me backward while the woman in front of me braced her arm against my knees, her jaw pressed to the rucksack on my lap. As the heat in the plane climbed over 40 degrees Celsius, so did the intensity of our odor. We exuded the stink of sweat, of unwashed clothing, and of anxiety, with the only sucker being the breeze through the open door where a crewman stood in a rock guitarist's wide leg pose. Instead of a 6-string electric guitar slung low across his hips, he carried an M16 with a 20-round magazine. As we taxied along the runway, I caught glimpses of concrete revetments, giant cans sliced in half lengthwise, and a desolate row of incinerated warbirds, demolished jets blown up in a strafing run earlier this evening, wings plucked and scattered like those of abused flies. A hush blanketed the passengers. Hypnotized by trepidation and anticipation, they were, no doubt, thinking what I was. "Goodbye, Vietnam. Au revoir, Saigon." The explosion was deafening, the force of it launching the crewmen onto the passengers. The last thing I saw for several moments as the flash of light through the open door washed the sight from my eyes. The general tumbled into me and I fell onto the bulkhead, then onto screaming bodies, hysterical civilians spraying my face with sour saliva. The tires of the plane squealed on the runway as it spun to the right, and when my sight returned, a blaze of fire shone through the door. I feared nothing more than burning to death, nothing more than being pureed by a propeller, nothing more than being quartered by Katyusha, which even sounded like the name of a demented Siberian scientist who had lost a few toes and a nose to frostbite. I had seen roasted remains before, in a desolate field outside of Hue, carbonized corpses fused into the metal of a downed Chinook, the fuel tanks having incinerated the 36 occupants, their teeth exposed in a permanent simian rictus, the flesh of their lips and the faces burnt off, the skin a finely charred obsidian, smooth and alien, all the hair converted to ash, no longer recognizable as my countrymen or as human beings. I did not want to die that way. I did not want to die in any way, least of all in a long-range bombardment from the artillery of my communist comrades, launched from the suburbs they had captured outside Saigon. A hand squeezed my chest and reminded me I was still alive. Another clawed my ear as the howling people beneath me struggled to heave me off. Pushing back to try to right myself, I found my hand on someone's oily head and myself pressed against the general. Another explosion somewhere on the runway heightened the frenzy. Men, women, and children caterwauled at an even higher pitch. All of a sudden the plane halted its gyrations at such an angle where the eye of the door did not look out onto the fire, but only onto the darkness. And a man screamed, "We are all going to die." The loadmaster, cursing inventively, began the lowering of the ramp, and when the refugees surged forward against the opening, they bore me backward with them. The only way to survive being trampled to death was to cover my head with my rucksack and roll down the ramp, knocking people down as I did so. Another rocket exploded on the runway a few hundred meters behind us, lighting up an acre of tarmac and revealing the nearest shelter to be a battered concrete divider 50 meters from the runway. Even after the explosion faded, the disturbed night was no longer dark. The plane's starboard engines were aflame, two blazing torches spewing gusts of spark and smoke. I was on my hands and knees when Bond seized me by the elbow, dragging me with one hand and Lin with the other. She in turn carried a wailing Duke, her arm wrapped around his chest. A meteorite shower of rockets and artillery shells was falling on the runways, an apocalyptic light show that revealed the evacuees dashing for the concrete divider, stumbling and tripping along the way, suitcases forgotten, the thundering prop wash from the two remaining engines blowing little children off their feet and staggering adults. Those who had reached the divider kept their whimpering heads below the concrete, and when something whizzed overhead, a fragment or a bullet, I fell to the earth and began crawling. Bond did likewise with Lin, her face tense but determined. By the time we fumbled our way to an unoccupied space at the divider, the crew had turned off the engines. The relief from the noise only made audible that someone was shooting at us. Bullets zipped overhead or ricocheted off the concrete. The gunners zeroing in on the bonfire of the burning plane. "Our guys," Bond said, knees drawn up to his chest and one arm thrown around Duke, huddled between him and Lin. "They're pissed. They want a seat out there." "No way," I said. "That's NVA. They've taken the perimeter, even though I thought there was a fairly good chance it was our own men venting their frustrations." Then the plane's gas tanks blew, the fireball illuminating a vast stretch of the airfield, and when I turned my face away from the bonfire, I found that I was next to the sub-undersecretary, a civil servant, unextraordinaire, his face nearly pressed against my back, and the message in his Chihuahua eyes as clear as the title on a cinema marquee. Like the communist agent and the lieutenant at the gate, he would have been happy to see me dead. I deserved his hatred. After all, I had denied him a considerable fortune as a result of my unannounced visit to his house, the address procured for me by the Louche Major. "It is true I have some visas," the sub-undersecretary had said as we sat in his living room. "I and some colleagues are making them available in the interest of justice. Isn't it unjust that only the most privileged or fortunate have the opportunity to escape?" I made some sympathetic noises. "If there was true justice," he he went on, everyone would leave who needed to. That is clearly not the case. But this puts someone like me in rather difficult circumstances. Why should I be the judge of who gets to leave and who does not? I am, after all, a merely glorified secretary. If you were in my situation, Captain, what would you do? I can appreciate the situation you find yourself in, sir. My dimples hurt from smiling, and I was impatient to arrive at the inevitable end game. But the middle had to be played, to provide me with the same moth-eaten moral covers he had already pulled up to his chin. You are clearly a respectable man of taste and values. Here I nodded to the left and right, gesturing at the tidy house that had to be paid for. Plastered walls were dotted with a few geckos and some decorative objects, clock, calendar, Chinese scroll, and colorized photograph of Mo Din Diem in better days, when he had not yet been assassinated for believing he was a president and not an American puppet. Now the little man in a white suit was a saint to his fellow Vietnamese Catholics, having suffered an appropriately martyred death with hands hawk-tied, face masked in blood, a Rorschach blot of his cerebral tissue decorating the interior of an American armored personnel carrier, his humiliation captured in a photograph circulated worldwide. Its subtext was as subtle as Al Capone. Do not fuck with the United States of America. The real injustice, I said, beginning to get heated, is that an honest man must live a penurious life in our country. Therefore, please allow me to extend to you a small token of the appreciation of my patron for the favor that he is requesting. You do have enough visas on hand for 92 people, do you not? I was not certain he would, in which case my plan was to put down a deposit and promise to return with the remainder. But when the sub-undersecretary replied affirmatively, I produced the envelope of remaining cash, $4,000, enough for 2 visas if he was feeling generous. The sub-undersecretary unsealed the envelope and ran his thumb, calloused by experience, over the sheaf of bills. He knew immediately how much money was in the envelope. Not enough. He slapped the cheek of the coffee table with the white glove of the envelope, and as if that were an insufficient expression of his outrage, he slapped the cheek again. How dare you attempt to bribe me, sir? I motioned to him to sit down. Like him, I, too, was a man trapped by difficult circumstances, forced to do what I must do. Is it just for you to sell these visas when they cost you nothing, and were not yours to begin with? I asked him. And would it not be just for me to call the local police commander and have him arrest us both? And would it not be just for him to appropriate your visas and engage in some just retribution of his own? So the most just solution is simply for us to return to the situation where I offered you $4,000 for 92 visas, since you should not even have 92 visas or $4,000 to begin with. After all, you can return to your desk tomorrow and procure another 92 visas easily enough. They're only paper, aren't they? But to a bureaucrat, paper was never just paper. Paper was life. He hated me then for taking his paper, and he hated me now. But I was not bothered in the least. What bothered me as I huddled at the concrete divider was yet another miserable weight, only this time one with no clear solution. The glimmer of a rising sun brought a measure of comfort, but the shooting bluish light showed the tarmac to be in an awful state, chipped and pitted by rocket and artillery explosions. In the middle of it all was the smoldering slag heap of the C-130, exuding the pungent stink of burning fuel. Between us and the embers of the plane were little dark heaps that gradually took shape, becoming suitcases and valises abandoned in the mad rush, some of them burst open and spilling their entrails hither and thither. The sun continued rising notch by notch on its rack, the light becoming harsher and brighter until it achieved the retina-numbing quality generated by an interrogator's lamp, stripping away every vestige of shade. Pinned down on the east side of the divider, people began to wilt and shrivel, beginning with the elderly and the children. "Water, Mama," Duke said. All Lin could say was, "No, darling, we don't have any water, but we'll get some soon." On cue, another Hercules appeared in the sky, approaching so fast and steep a kamikaze pilot might have been at the controls. The C-130 landed with a screech of tires on a distant runway, and a murmur rose from the evacuees. Only when the Hercules turned in our direction to approach haphazardly across intervening runways did that murmur turn into a cheer. Then I heard something else. When I poked my head over the divider cautiously, I saw them, darting out of the shadows of hangars and between revetments where they must have been hiding. Dozens, maybe hundreds of Marines and soldiers and military cops and Air Force pilots and crewmen and mechanics, the air base's staff and rear guard, refusing to be heroes or sacrificial goats. Spotting this competition, the evacuees stampeded toward the C-130, which had pivoted on the runway 50 meters away and lowered its ramp in a not-so-coy gesture of invitation. The general and his family ran ahead of me. Bond and his family ran behind me, and together we brought up the rear of the fleeting masses. The first of the evacuees was running up the ramp when I heard the hiss of the Katyushas, followed a second later by an explosion as the first of the rockets detonated on a far runway. Bullets whizzed overhead, and this time we heard the distinct bark of the AK-47 along with the M-16. "They're at the perimeter!" Bond shouted. It was clear to the evacuees that this Hercules would be the last plane out of the airport. If it could even take off with communist units closing in, and they once more began screaming with fear. As they rushed up the ramp as fast as they could, a slick little airplane on the far side of the divider shrieked into the air. A needle-nosed Tiger fighter, followed by a Huey helicopter thumping by with its doors flung wide open, revealing more than a dozen soldiers squeezed inside. What remained of the armed forces at the airport was evacuating itself with whatever air mobile vehicle was at hand. As the general pushed on the backs of the evacuees in front of him to propel them toward the ramp, and as I pushed the general, a dual-hulled shadow gunship soared from the tarmac to my left. I watched it out of the corner of my eye. The shadow was a funny-looking plane, the fat fuselage suspended between two hulls, but there was nothing funny about the smoke trail of the heat-seeking missile scribbling its way across the sky until its flaming tip kissed the shadow at less than 1,000 feet. When the two halves of the airplane and the bits and pieces of its crew fell to the earth like the shattered fragments of a clay pigeon, the evacuees groaned and shoved even harder to make the final climb up the ramp. As the general set foot on the ramp, I paused to let Lin and Duke pass by. When they did not appear, I turned and saw that they were no longer behind me. "Get on the plane!" our loadmaster shouted beside me, his mouth opened so wide I swear I saw his tonsils vibrating. "Your friends are gone, man!" 20 meters away, Bond was kneeling on the tarmac, clutching Lin to his breast. A red heart slowly expanded on her white blouse. A puff of concrete dust rose when a bullet pinged off the runway between us, and every last drop of moisture in my mouth evaporated. I tossed my rucksack at the loadmaster and ran straight and fast toward them, hurdling abandoned suitcases. I slid the last 2 meters, feet first, and shaving the skin off my left hand and elbow. Bond was making sounds I had never heard from him before, deep, guttural bellows of pain. Between him and Lin was Duke. His eyes rolled back in his head, and when I pried husband and wife apart, I saw the wet, bloody mess of Duke's chest where something had torn through it and through his mother. The general and the loadmaster were yelling something I could not understand over the increasing whine of the propellers. "Let's go," I shouted. "They're leaving." I pulled at his sleeve, but Bond would not move, rooted by grief. I had no choice but to punch him in the jaw, just hard enough to shut him up and loosen his grip. Then, with one tug, I pried Lin from his arms, and when I did so, Duke tumbled onto the tarmac, his head limp. Bond screamed something inarticulate as I ran for the airplane, Lin thrown over my shoulder and making no noise as her body bumped against me, her blood hot and wet on my shoulder and neck. The general and the loadmaster stood on the ramp beckoning me as the plane taxied away, aiming for any clear stretch of runway as the Katyushas kept arriving, singly and in salvos. I was running as fast as I could, my lungs in a knot, and when I reached the ramp I threw Lin at the general, who caught her by the arms. Then Bond was at my side, running with me, extending Duke with both hands to the loadmaster, who took him as gently as he could, even though it did not matter, not the way Duke's head flopped from side to side. With his son handed off, Vaughn began to slow down, head bowed in agony and still sobbing. I grabbed him by the crook of his elbow, and with one last push I shoved him face forward onto the ramp, where the loadmaster seized him by the collar and pulled him up the rest of the way. I leapt for the ramp, arms extended, landing on it with the side of my face and all of my ribcage, the grit and dirt and dust against my cheek while my legs flailed in open air. With the plane barreling down the runway, the general pulled me to my knees and dragged me into the hold, the ramp rising behind me. I was squeezed against the general on one side and the prostrate bodies of Duke and Lin on the other, a wall of evacuees pushing against us from the front. As the airplane ascended steeply, a terrible noise rose with it, audible not only through the straining metal, but through the clamor from the open side door, where the crewman stood with his M-16, firing 3-round bursts from the hip. Through that open door, the patchy landscape of fields and tenements tilted and wheeled as the pilot took us into a corkscrew, and I realized that the terrible noise was not only coming from the engines, but from Bond, too, pounding his head against the ramp and howling, not as if the world had ended, but as if someone had gouged out his eyes. Chapter 4 Shortly after we landed on Guam, a green ambulance arrived to take the bodies. I lowered Duke onto a stretcher. His little body had grown heavier in my arms with each passing minute, but I could not lay him down on the grubby tarmac. After the medics draped him with a white sheet, they eased Lin from Bond's arms, and likewise covered her before loading mother and son into the ambulance. I wept, but I was no match for Bond, who had a lifetime's worth of unused tears to spend. We continued to weep as we were trucked to Camp Asan, where, thanks to the general, we were given barracks that were luxurious compared to the tents waiting for the other late arrivals. Catatonic on his bunk, Bond would remember nothing of the evacuation playing on television that afternoon and through the next day. Nor would he remember how, in the barracks and tents of our temporary city, thousands of refugees wailed as if attending a funeral, the burial of their nation, dead too soon, as so many were, at the tender 21 years of age. Along with the general's family and 100 others in the barracks, I watched inglorious images of helicopters landing on Saigon's roofs, evacuating refugees to the decks of airplane carriers. The next day, after communist tanks crashed through the gates of the presidential palace, communist troops raised the flag of the National Liberation Front from the palace roof. As the debacle unfolded, the calcium and lime deposits of memory from the last days of the damned republic encrusted themselves in the pipes of my brain. Just a little more would be added late that night, after a dinner of baked chicken and green beans, many of the refugees found exotically inedible, the children the only ones in the cafeteria with any appetite. Joining a line to turn in our trays to the dishwashers was the coup de grace, pronouncing us no longer adult citizens of a sovereign country, but stateless refugees protected, for the moment, by the American military. After scraping his untouched green beans into the garbage, the general looked at me and said, "Captain, our people need me. I'm going to walk among them and boost their morale. Let's go." "Yes, sir," I said, not optimistic about his chances, but also not thinking of possible complications. While it was easy enough to spread the manure of encouragement among soldiers drilled into accepting all kinds of abuse, we had forgotten that most of the refugees were civilians. In retrospect, I was fortunate not to be wearing my uniform, stained with Lin's blood. I had shed it in favor of the Madras shirt and chinos in my rucksack. But the general, having lost his luggage at the airport, still wore his stars on his collar. Outside our barracks and in the tent city, few knew who he was by face. What they saw was his uniform and rank, and when he said hello to the civilians and asked how they were faring, they met him with sullen silence. The slight crinkle between his eyes and his hesitant chuckling told me he was confused. My sense of unease increased with every step down the dirt lane between the tents, civilian eyes on us and the silence unbroken. We had barely walked 100 meters into the tent city when the first assault came. A dainty slipper sailing from our flank and striking the